This is Lorraine bringing it to you, reading Let the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, Chapter 57, The Firefly. They slept the first night on the beach, and he moved into the shack with her the next day, packing and unpacking within a single tide, as sand creatures do. As they walked along the tide line in late afternoon, he took her hand and looked at her. "Will you marry me, Kaya?" "We are married, like the geese," she said. "Okay, I can live with that." Each morning they rose at dawn, and while Tate percolated coffee, Kaya fried corn fritters in Ma's old iron skillet, blackened and dented, or stirred grits and eggs as sunrise eased over the lagoon. The heron, posing one leg in the mist, they cruised estuaries, waded waterways, and slipped through narrow streams, collecting feathers and amoebas. In the evenings, they drifted in her old boat until sunset, then swam naked in moonlight, or loved in beds of cool ferns. Archibald Ladd offered Kaya a job, but she turned it down and continued writing her books. She and Tate hired the fix-it man again, and he built a lab and studio of raw wood, hand-hewn posts, and tin roof for her behind the shack. Tate gave her a microscope and installed work tables, shelves, and closets for her specimens, trays of instruments and supplies. Then they refurbished the shack, adding a new bedroom and bath, a larger sitting room. She insisted on keeping the kitchen as it was and the exterior unpainted, so that the dwelling, more of a cabin now, remained weathered and real. From a phone in Sea Oaks, she called Jody and invited him and his wife, Libby, for a visit. The four of them explored the marsh and fished some. When Jody pulled in a large brim, Kaya squealed, "Looky there, you got one big as Alabama." They fried up fish and hush puppies big as goose eggs. Kaya never went to Barker Cove again in her life, and for the most part, she and Tate spent their time in the marsh alone. The villagers saw her only as a distant shape gliding through fog, and over the years, the mysteries of her story became legend, told over and over with buttermilk pancakes and hot pork sausages at the diner. The theories and gossip over how Chase Andrews died never stopped. As time passed, most everyone agreed the sheriff never should have arrested her. After all, there was no hard evidence against her, no real proof of a crime. It had been truly cruel to treat a shy, natural creature that way. Now and then, a new sheriff, Jackson was never elected again, would open the folder, make some inquiries about other suspects, but not much came of it. Over the years, the case, too, eased into legend, and though Kaya was never completely healed from the scorn and suspicion surrounding her, a soft contentment, a near happiness, settled into her. Kaya lay on the soft duff near the lagoon one afternoon, waiting for Tate to return from a collecting trip. She breathed deep, knowing he would always come back, that for the first time in her life, she would not be abandoned. She heard the deep purr of his cruiser, chugging up the channel, could feel the quiet rumble through the ground. She sat up as his boat pushed through the thickets and waved to him at the helm. He waved back, but didn't smile. She stood. He tied the small wharf he had built and walked up. He tied to the small wharf he had built and walked up to her on the shore. "Kaya, I'm so sorry. I have bad news. Jumpin' died last night in his sleep." An ache pushed against her heart. All those who left her had chosen to do so. This was different. This was not rejection. This was like the cooper's hawk returning to the sky. Tears rolled down her cheeks, and Tate held her. Tate and almost everyone in town went to Jumpin' Spooner. Kaya did not, but after the services, she walked to Jumpin' and Mabel's house with some blackberry jam long overdue. Kaya paused at the fence. Friends and family stood in the dirt yard, swept clean as a whistle. Some talked, some laughed at old Jumpin' stories, and some cried. As she opened the gate, everyone looked at her, then stepped aside to make a path. Standing on the porch, Mabel rushed to Kaya. They hugged, rocking back and forth, crying. "Lord, he loved you like his own daughter," Mabel said. "I know," Kaya said, "and he was my pa." Later, Kaya walked to her beach and said farewell to Jumpin' in her own words, in her own way, alone. And as she wandered the beach, remembering Jumpin', thoughts of her mother pushed into her mind, as though Kaya were once again the little girl of six. She saw Ma walking down the sandy lane in her old gator shoes, maneuvering the deep ruts. But in this version, Ma stopped at the end of the trail and looked back, waving her hand high in farewell. She smiled at Kaya, turning into the road, and disappeared into the forest. And this time, finally, it was okay. With no tears or censure, Kaya whispered, "Goodbye, Ma." She thought of the others briefly, Pa, her brother and sisters, but she didn't have enough of that bygone family to bid farewell. That regret faded, too, when Jody and Libby began bringing their two children, Murph and Mindy, to visit Kaya and Tate several times a year. Once again, the shack swelled with family around the old cook stove, serving up Ma's corn fritters, scrambled eggs, and sliced tomatoes. But this time, there was laughter and love. Barkley Cove changed over the years. A man from Raleigh built a fancy marina where Jumpin' Shack had leaned for more than 100 years. With bright blue awnings over each slip, yachts could pull in. Boaters from up and down the coastline moseyed up to Barkley Cove and paid $3.50 for an espresso. Little sidewalk cafes with smart colored umbrellas and art galleries with seascapes sprouted on Main. A lady from New York opened a gift shop that sold everything the villagers didn't need, but every tourist had to have. Almost every shop had a special table displaying the books by Catherine Danielle Clark, local author, award-winning biologist. Grits were listed on the menus as polenta in mushroom sauce and cost $6. And one day, some women from Ohio walked into the doggone beer hall, never imagining they were the first females to pass through the door, and ordered spicy shrimp and paper boats and beer now on draft. Adults of either sex or any color can walk through the door now, but the window, which was cut out of the wall so that women could order from the sidewalk, is still there. Tate continued his job at the lab, and Kaya published several more award-winning books. And though she was granted many accolades, including an honorary doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, she never once accepted the invitation to speak at universities or museums. Tate and Kaya hoped for a family, but a child never came. Disappointment wove them together closer, and they were seldom separated for more than a few hours of any day. Sometimes Kaya walked alone to the beach, and as the sunset streaked the sky, she felt the waves pounding her heart. She'd reach down and touch the sand, then stretch her arms toward the clouds, feeling the connections. Not the connections Ma and Mabel had spoken of. Kaya never had her troop of close friends, nor the connections Jody described, but she never had her own family. She knew the years of isolation had altered her behavior until she was different from others, but it wasn't her fault she'd been alone. Most of what she knew, she'd learned from the wild. Nature had nurtured, tutored, and protected her when no one else would. If consequences resulted from her behaving differently, then they too were functions of life's fundamental core. Kate's devotion eventually convinced her that human love is more than the bizarre mating competitions of the marsh creatures. But life also taught her that ancient genes for survival still persist in some undesirable forms among the twists and turns of man's genetic code. For Kaya, it was enough to be part of this natural sequence, as sure as the tides. She was bonded to her planet and its life in a way few people are, rooted solid in this earth, born of this mother. At 64, Kaya's long black hair had turned as white as the sand. One evening, she did not return from a collecting trip, so Tate puttered around in the marsh, searching. As dusk eased in, he came around the bend and saw her drifting in her boat in a lagoon surrounded by sycamores touching the sky. She had slumped backward, her head lying against the old knapsack. He called her name softly, and when she didn't move, he shouted, then screamed. Pulling his boat next to hers, he stumbled awkwardly into the stern of her boat. Reaching out his long arms, he took her shoulders and gently shook her. Her head slumped farther to the side, her eyes not seen. "Kaya, Kaya, no, no," he screamed. "Still young, so beautiful." Her heart had quietly stopped. She had lived long enough to see the bald eagles make a comeback. For Kaya, that was long enough. Holding her in his arms, he rocked back and forth, weeping. He wrapped her in a blanket and towed her back to her lagoon in the old boat through the maze of creeks and estuaries, passing the herons and deer for the last time. "And I'll hide the maid in a cypress tree when the footsteps of death is near." He got special permission for her to be buried on her land under an oak overlooking the sea, and the whole town came out for the funeral. Kaya would not have believed the long lines of slow-moving mourners. Of course, Jody and his family came, and all of Tate's cousins. Some curiosity seekers attended, but most people came out of respect for how she had survived years alone in the wild. Some remembered the little girl dressed in an oversized, shabby coat, boating to the wharf, walking barefoot to the grocery store to buy grits. Others came to her graveside because her books had taught them how the marsh links the land to the sea, both needing the other. By now, Tate understood that her nickname was not Fool. Only few become legend. So he chose as the epitaph for her tombstone, Catherine Danielle Clark, Kaya, the Marsh Girl, 1945-2009. The evening of her funeral, when everyone was finally gone, Tate stepped into her homemade lab. He carefully labeled samples. More than 50 years' worth was the longest-running, most complete collection of his kind. She had requested that it be donated to Archibald Lab, and someday he would do so, but parting with it now was unthinkable. Walking into the shack, as she called it, Tate felt the walls exhaling her breath. the floors whispering her steps, so clear he called out her name. Then he stood against the wall, weeping. He lifted the old knapsack and held it to his chest. The officials at the courthouse had asked Tate to look for her will and birth certificate. In the old back bedroom, which had once been her parents', he rummaged through the closet and found boxes of her life stuffed in the bottom, almost hidden under some blankets. He pulled them onto the floor and sat beside them. Ever so carefully, he opened the old cigar box, the one where all the collecting began. The box still smelled of sweet tobacco and little girl. Among a few birds' feathers, insects, wings, and seeds was the small jar with the ashes from a Ma's letter and a bottle of Revlon fingernail polish, barely pink. The bits and bones of a life, the stones of her stream. Tucked in the bottom was the deed for the property, which Kaya had put in a conservation easement, protecting it from development. At least this fragment of the marsh would always be wild. But there was no will or personal papers, which did not surprise her. She would not have thought of such things. Tate planned to live out his days at her place, knowing she had wanted that and that Jody would not object. Late in the day, the sun dipping behind the lagoon, he stirred corn mush for the gulls and mindlessly glanced at the kitchen floor. He cocked his head as he noticed for the first time that the linoleum had not been installed under the wood pile or the old stove. Kaya had kept firewood stacked high, even in summer, but now it was low, and he saw the edge of a cutout in the floorboard. He moved the remaining logs aside and saw a trap door in the plywood. Kneeling down, he slowly opened it to find an enclosed compartment between the joists, which held, among other things, an old cardboard box covered in dust. He pulled it out and found inside scores of manila envelopes and a smaller box. All the envelopes were marked with the initials AH, and from them he pulled out pages and pages of poetry by Amanda Hamilton, the local poet who had published simple verses in regional magazines. Tate had thought Hamilton's poems rather weak, but Kai had always saved the published clippings, and here were envelopes full of them. Some of the written pages were completed poems, but most of them were unfinished, with lines crossed out and some words rewritten in the margin in the poet's handwriting. Kaya's handwriting. Amanda Hamilton was Kaya. Kaya was the poet. Tate's face grimaced in disbelief. Through the years, she must have put the poems in the rusty mailbox, submitting them to local publications, safe behind a nom de plume. Perhaps a reaching out, a way to express her feelings to someone other than gold, somewhere for her words to go. He glanced through some of the poems, most about nature or love. One was folded neatly in his own envelope. He read it out. He pulled it out and read, "The Firefly." Luring him was as easy as flashing valentines. But like a lady firefly, they hid a secret call to die. A final touch, unfinished. The last step, a trap. Down, down, he falls. His eyes still holding mine, until they see another world. I saw them change. First a question, then an answer, finally an end. And love itself passing to whatever it was before it began. A.H. Still kneeling on the floor, he read it again. He held the paper next to his heart, throbbing inside his chest. He looked out the window, making certain no one was coming down the lane. Not that they would. Why would they? But to be sure. Then he opened the small box, knowing what he would find. There, laid out carefully on cotton, was the shell necklace Chase had worn until the night he died. Tate sat at the kitchen table for a long time, taking it in, imagining her riding on night buses, catching a riptide, planning around the moon, softly calling to Chase in the darkness, pushing him backward, then squatting in mud at the bottom, lifting his head, heavy with death, to retrieve the necklace, covering her footprint, leaving no trace, breaking, kindling into bits. Tate built a fire in the old wood stove, and envelope by envelope, burned the poems. Maybe he didn't need to burn them all. Maybe he should have destroyed just the one. But he wasn't thinking clearly. The old, yellowed paper made a great whoosh, a foot high, then smoldered. He took the shell off the rawhide, dropped the rawhide in the fire, and put the boards back in the floor. Then, in near dusk, he walked to the beach and stood on a sharp bed of white and cracked mullet and crab pieces. For a second, he stared at Chase's shell in his open palm and then dropped it on the sand. Looking the same as all the others, it vanished. The tide was coming in, and a wave flowed over his feet, taking with it hundreds of seashells back into the sea. Kaya had been of this land and of this water. Now they would take her back, keep her secrets deep. And then the gulls came. Seeing him there, they spiraled above his head, calling, calling. As night fell, Tate walked back toward the shack. But when he reached the lagoon, he stopped under the deep canopy and watched hundreds of fireflies beckoning far into the dark reaches of the marsh, way out yonder where the crawdads sink. This is Lorraine, bringing it to you, reading Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, chapter 57, The Firefly, and the conclusion of this book.